You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Dean Kinetter. Coming up, libraries around the state are using federal relief funds to expand the services they offer. We'll find out what they're doing, and we'll invite you to call in about your local library.
Now, an armed assailant shot 13 people at a supermarket in Buffalo, New York over the weekend, leaving 10 people dead.
Most of the victims of the shooting were black, and authorities are investigating the attack as a racially motivated hate crime.
In online posts attributed to him, the accused perpetrator expressed white supremacist and anti-black ideas, including a conspiracy theory known as the Great Replacement. Our next guest says that idea was for a while on the fringes, but has become increasingly mainstream.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about domestic extremism in the U.S.? Do you have questions about extremist ideas and how they spread? Have you heard a version of this Great Replacement theory online or on TV? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Cynthia Miller Idris is the director of the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab at American University. It's also called PERIL for short. She's the author of two books on extremism. Her most recent is Hate in the Homeland, the New Global Far Right. Cynthia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about this great replacement conspiracy theory and where it came from?
Yes. Well, the theory itself, the conspiracy, has roots, obviously, that have been around a long time. So in the U.S. for decades, there's been a conspiracy theory called white genocide, which says that there's an orchestrated plot to eradicate white civilizations. And in Europe, there's been a conspiracy theory called Eurabia, which says that Muslim elites are trying to expand the caliphate through demographic change and immigration. And so these roots have been there for a really long time. But about a decade ago, this conspiracy called the Great Replacement kind of became an umbrella concept on dark spaces online that united sort of white supremacists across the world. And we saw terrorist attacks in Oslo and in Christchurch, New Zealand, and then El Paso, Pittsburgh, here and now in Buffalo, that have all been really mobilized by those same ideas, that it's an orchestrated plot, that it is to gain power, and that there is an existential threat to white people. So it really is circulates in dark spaces online and mobilizes terrorist actors. But over the past couple of years, we've seen it much more frequently show up in mainstream political discourse and on cable news networks as well.
Before we turn to that mainstreaming, can you talk about, is it an informal online network that really promotes and harbors these ideas now online?
Yeah, this is a great question, because it's really hard to explain how networked online extremism works. It is, I think it's exactly the way to describe it, is that it is like a network. These are not lone wolves or lone actors in the sense of completely isolated people out in a cabin somewhere. They are very socially engaged online, but they're not members typically of groups the way that 20 or 30 years ago we would see. And even today, there are extremist groups where people have, initiation rites and membership lists, and you sign up and you're a card-carrying member of an extremist group. That does still exist, but the vast majority of what's happening today is young people, especially spending time, teenagers and young adults, on meme-sharing sites, watching videos, in online gaming chat rooms, sharing texts with their friends that have memes or video snippets or jokes that have really racist and misogynist and disgusting kind of content in them, that also that in some of these cases explain that there's a conspiracy or refer to a conspiracy called the Great Replacement. So the terrorist shooter in Christchurch, his manifesto was called the Great Replacement. I mean, this became a kind of unifying, and he live streamed his attack as well, just like the Buffalo shooter did. And so there was a lot of imitation here. Even the Buffalo shooter really plagiarized most of the so-called manifesto. Those 180 pages was plagiarized, the content from the Christchurch manifesto.
We're talking to Cynthia Miller Idris, director of the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab at American University, looking at a conspiracy theory, the replacement, great replacement theory cited by the perpetrator, the alleged perpetrator of the Buffalo shooting. She says it's getting more mainstream, though. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. You could tell us if you've encountered this. Now, you mentioned, Cynthia, you're seeing this more, a version of this more in American politics and media. I want to listen to U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, Republican from Wisconsin. He was talking here about immigration at the U.S.-Mexico border on Fox News last year.
This administration wants complete open borders, and you have to ask yourself why. Is it really they want to remake the demographics of America to ensure that they stay in power forever? Is that what's happening here? Because the human depredations that's being caused by their policies, they're just untold.
Senator Johnson made a similar statement last month in a radio interview. I think Republicans and some on the media, including Tucker Carlson, are saying, wait, we're saying something different than this replacement theory in its classic form. Their argument is Democrats want to allow immigrants in, give them amnesty and let them vote. Amnesty, of course, wouldn't let them vote. But that's the basic idea. How strong a connection do you see between those two versions?
I would say the mainstream version of it is it's an echo of the darker terrorist version of it. And it shares features. So there's still a plot, there's still orchestration, there's some kind of conspiracy to do it. And it's positioning the change that's coming, a demographic change, as a terrible outcome. It's often using dehumanizing language against immigrants, referring to dirty or poor immigrants, for example. We hear that sometimes in the same context as we hear replacing. And it'll use language like traditional America is being replaced, instead of talking about going straight to the issue of race. There's a lot of euphemisms. It's softer. And they're not calling for violence. That's a really important distinction. But it creates a bridge, I think, is a way of thinking about it, or an echo. So when someone is encountering the dark version of this online, and then maybe their parents are listening to a cable, listening to Fox News in the background, or they hear somebody at the dinner table mention the similar kinds of things, that's where the potential, I think, for reinforcement comes in.
Now, of course, the worst case is an attack like the one we saw in Buffalo this weekend. How do you see that happening? Someone going from being exposed to these ideas, then embracing them, and then acting on them in this horrific burst of violence?
Well, there's very little research that tells us actually what makes one person who is radicalized become violent and take that leap to violence while another person does not. So, that's really tricky. You can actually only look at it afterward. But there are some key elements that people share in common across violent actors. And one is that they often position themselves as being heroic. So, they believe they're saving somebody, their people, or that they are called upon to act as martyrs. And so at some point they've encountered bad content online, often shared from, in a text chat with a group of friends from school, or a meme, or they go to these chan sites or in an online gaming chat where they're encountering these ideas. Somebody shares a hyperlink. I mean, this is the way the ecosystem works online, that takes them to another video, and then the algorithm recommends videos that other people have watched. And that can lead them darker and darker and sort of deeper into a rabbit hole of propaganda. And there's been pretty good coverage showing that that can happen pretty quickly, even within the span of a few days. If you're in a binge watching period, you can encounter content that later gets banned, right? Because the content moderation is always slower and people do see stuff. So, but then once people believe this, they really deeply believe the conspiracy theory, what typically mobilizes them to action is some combination of wanting to be a part of something bigger and better than themselves. They think that they're acting to save their people, or they really want a sense of power and they want to be admired or imitated by others. And we really saw that very clearly here in this Buffalo case, where he's trying to get others to follow him.
And you offer through your organization, PERL, the Polarization Extremism Research and Innovation Lab, advice for parents and others if they worry that a youth in their life, their own kid, may be going down this path. We've got a link at WPR.org/Central Time, some of those resources. What kind of off-roads are there?
It's a great question. And, you know, we created that Parents and Caregivers Guide at the start of the pandemic when we were watching so many millions of teens and kids go online all the time, and also knew that propaganda was circulating in higher amounts. So we were really concerned about parents and caregivers being kind of now the frontline adults who might be able to recognize warning signs. So the first thing we advise parents to do is try to react with curiosity. When you do hear warning signs, when we've had parents say their kids have started expressing extreme misogyny during the pandemic, for example, or they hear their child say something that's Holocaust denial related, you know, or making a joke about something horrific. And often parents react with shame and they shame their child. Those aren't our values. And what are you doing? Or they punish them. And that can actually drive kids, especially further online, into spaces where they are then welcomed and celebrated. And people say your parents just are triggered snowflakes who can't take a joke. And things can get worse. So we try to urge parents, it's very hard, but to react with curiosity, to try to treat their kids as experts, ask them, where did you find that? Can you explain what a meme is? How does this space work where you spend a lot of time? And trying to draw them out and then start to disentangle what is underneath and behind it so they can start to kind of understand.
We're talking to Cynthia Miller-Idris, professor and director of the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab at American University. We're looking at extremist ideology and the potential link to violence.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think misinformation and disinformation play a big role in the spread of these extremist ideas? Do you worry about young people being radicalized online? Have you encountered this in your own life? Should there be more training for adults to spot the warning signs of radicalization? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Dean Knetter. We're talking about extremism in the U.S. after a mass shooting in Buffalo, New York last week. Cynthia Miller-Idris with American University stays with us.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your comments, maybe your own experiences. If you've encountered these ideas, maybe on social media or elsewhere, 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's bring on a caller now. Bernie is with us in Valders. Bernie, hi.
Hi. I just want to say that, everything old is new again. Yes, we have the internet now, but just give you a brief background to my family. my father was a survivor of Neuengamme concentration camp. And he was actually captured by the Germans in Ukraine. He was born in Ukraine, which was then the Second Republic of Poland, sent to Neuengamme, which was a slave labor camp. And for a lot of the same reasons, you know, there was just an economic hatred between Ukrainians, Poles, Germans. Of course, we all know the story of the Nazis, but long story short, he came to the U.S., got to the U.S., and people who were brought here as immigrants, refugees after the war, were known as DPs, displaced persons. And, you know, growing up, I heard the term damn DP an awful lot, and I didn't really understand what it was then, but eventually my dad brought us here to Wisconsin because he didn't like what was happening to him. Every time he opened his mouth with his deep Eastern European accent, in the early 60s, somebody accused him of being a communist. We came here, here into Wisconsin, and my dad bought a farm. He had saved up enough money to buy a farm near Mount Calvary. The local guy who wanted to buy the farm was angry with my dad for buying the farm, and in a conversation with him said the following: our boys went over to Europe and fought and died for your people, and now you come here and you marry our women and take our land.
Bernie, thank you for sharing, obviously, a still painful story. Cynthia, Bernie sees a long history of this suspicion of the immigrant.
There is a long history, and we're hearing, and I hear the pain in Bernie's story and the way that carried across generations. I mean, when we talk about intergenerational trauma, the kind of trauma that people carry on, when we hear and in hearing the pain in the communities, voices in Buffalo right now, is so palpable too. And feeling, that it's really important to not just pay attention here to the perpetrators of hate and harm and violence and terrorism, but also to how we direct resources to survivors and to victims and to communities who are the most harmed, by those actions.
Bernie, thanks for sharing your family's story at 800-642-1234. Jackie joins us next in Illinois. Jackie, hello. Are you there, Jackie? Oh, we lost Jackie. Jackie had said they don't agree that Fox News necessarily spreads replacement theory. They view themselves as a Fox viewer, but not a supporter of the great replacement theory. And I think looking at Fox News in particular, Cynthia, there is a news division. There are reporters. It's not necessarily wall to wall on the network. People have focused attention on the highly rated Tucker Carlson show in particular.
No, that's right. And, you know, and I do think it's important to distinguish between the great replacement conspiracy theory that's mobilizing terrorist violence and the versions of it that we're hearing on Fox News and from mainstream politicians, but also to recognize the harm. I mean, it is being celebrated by white supremacists online that it's being mentioned on Fox News and by Tucker Carlson. So we're using words like ally and saying, finally, you know, he's saying it. So it is seen as legitimizing within those spaces. And I think it's really important to understand that and to disavow it and to speak out against it. So I'm glad to hear, you know, hear him say that he is not a supporter of the Great Replacement. I think we should be hearing more people say that.
Even if the transmission of the Great Replacement theory doesn't lead to acts of violence, do you worry about it doing harm in other ways?
Yeah, I mean, it is, even if it's not violent, you know, we want a society. We are a country that has absorbed millions of immigrants, and that has, you know, that has been a place where people seek out opportunities, and we want that to be, you know, to continue to be the case. And so even when it doesn't mobilize violence, it mobilizes, it has discriminatory and racist and dehumanizing ideas attached to it that give people a sense of threat, that make them feel that they are, in danger, or that there is potential harm coming to their family or their traditions or their lives. And so I think one of the questions we should be asking is, you know, why is it a threat? Why is demographic change being perceived as such a threat? What does it take for everyone who lives in a country to feel at home in the place where they live?
Talking to Cynthia Miller Idris from the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab at American University, looking at far-right conspiracy theories and extremism. Cynthia, I want to spend our last few minutes looking at solutions. You've called for what you call a public health approach to violent extremism. What would that look like?
Well, you know, most of our allies overseas treat domestic extremism as a societal problem, not just a security problem. We in this country have framed this problem around the Department of Homeland Security, which, you know, has done a lot with what they have to prevent things, but it makes it really more about, screening and safety and sort of barricading the doors and training people to disarm in a crisis, right? And of course, you want some of that crisis training, and we have seen it be successful in places like the Colleyville hostage taking situation, where that rabbi was able to get away by using that training. But, you know, the way I often describe it is, I don't want to live in a world where barricading the doors is all that we can do, that's our measure of success. And I don't think anybody wants to live that way. So we want to prevent. A public health approach is saying, we treat this the same way that we've treated diabetes or cardiac disease, which is also educate communities about the attitudinal behavioral choices they can make that help them resist propaganda, and understand what manipulative rhetoric looks like online so they can make their own choices with all the freedoms of speech that we have to be safer in our own communities.
Now, we've seen things like the teaching of a race in schools in the U.S. get really politicized. I'm sure you're aware of that. But if kids don't talk about this in schools, are they going to see it, learn about it on the streets, or I guess more notably on the internet?
Yeah, I think that's exactly a really important point, which is that, you know, that there is a lot of information online, especially in these dark spaces, that presents false information about racial differences, that uses genetic and eugenicist kind of ways of thinking, that positions racial differences as biological and harmful. And if kids don't learn about racial inequality, and the legacies of racial inequality and racism in this country from trusted adults and curriculum that we know about, they are going to go ask those questions and be given answers online. And those answers often are full of propaganda and disinformation in ways that create tremendous harm. So I think of it as inoculating, as protecting, as pre-bunking the disinformation and the harmful content, and safeguarding young people, especially as they spend time online, by equipping them with the skills to be resilient.
Briefly, as we wrap up, given that all these issues are politicized, do you see those things having a chance of happening in schools?
Unfortunately, I think that, you know, we see it takes the deaths of so many people, that a tragedy like this, to have more open conversations now than I feel like we were able to have a week ago about it, where people are starting to understand, I think, the consequences of not having conversations about race in schools. So I do think that we have a chance. I just hope that it doesn't take another tragedy to move the needle further.
Cynthia, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Cynthia Miller Idris, director of the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab at American University, author of two books about extremism. She was with us today to talk about the Great Replacement Theory and how to counter domestic extremism after the shooting at a Buffalo, New York grocery store.
Coming up.
You can find resources, thanks Dean, for Peril on youth radicalization for parents, caregivers, educators, and more at WPR.org/Central Time.
Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, scientists have captured the first ever image of a massive black hole at the center of the Milky Way. A UW astronomer joins the show for a look at the discovery and what black holes do. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Dean Kinetter. Coming up at 6 on 1A+, Buffalo, New York is mourning after a deadly racist attack. Jen White and her guests look at what steps the country can take to act against those who spread white supremacy and whether anything will change. That's at 6 on 1A+.
Now, libraries around Wisconsin are making use of federal relief grant money they received during the pandemic.
33 Wisconsin projects received funding from the American Rescue Plan.
We're going to learn about what some of the different libraries and library systems are using that money for and the community services they're providing. And then coming up, we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234, a chance for you to talk about your local library, why you like it, how you use it. Have they offered special services over the last couple of years? How do they fit into the community? What would you like to see them do more of? Shout out to your library now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Madeline Fox reports on education for WPR. You can find her report on libraries linked at WPR.org/Central Time. Maddie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Well, there was a lot of money available through the American Rescue Plan. Can you give us a sense of how much of that funding found its way into Wisconsin and individual library systems here?
So specifically for libraries, we were looking at about $3 million from the American Rescue Plan Act that went to libraries, and the grant size varied from about $27,000 to about $200,000 to these individual libraries and library systems.
And you talked with library administrators and librarians around the state. We'll be joined by one here ourselves in just a minute. But can you give us an example of some of the projects you heard about that are being paid for with this federal relief money?
Yeah. So one that I thought was really interesting is the Spooner Library up in, I think, Northwest Wisconsin, has been partnering with a local food bank to do what they're calling books and bread. So it's this combination of like a food box and food access for people who would ordinarily go to a food bank, as well as sort of a portable bookmobile type situation where they bring, you know, tables worth of books to these sites twice a month when they dole out food as well. And so what they were able to ask for was a bookmobile, like a big formal one where they can have all the shelves on the inside and also have food, you know, places with that they can have colder storage and store different kinds of food. And then now they're able to drive all of that around in just an easier way and make it more of a, I don't know, like a holistic experience, and hopefully be able to transport more than they can in, say, cars or vans.
Sure. So expanding into different services and kind of pushing past the boundaries of the library building itself. Was that a theme you heard beyond just that that food truck or that bookmobile?
Yes, absolutely. Well, and I think libraries in general over the last, actually, I couldn't guess how long, but quite a while, have been working on sort of pushing the boundaries of their services outside the library, whether that is book bikes, bookmobiles, whether it is doing stuff like setting up tables at, you know, community farmers markets or craft fairs, and also sometimes co-hosting events with local bookstores or other local universities and places, just to sort of remind people that they're out there. It's a free service. They have a lot of different free services, and to remind people that that they can access all of this with just a library card, and they can access a lot of things outside of the library as well.
And what did librarians tell you, Maddie, about how they've had to adapt during the pandemic and maybe some opportunities that came out of that?
Yeah. So I think we've been seeing, again, over the last several years, a shift towards making more resources virtual and expanding virtual access to things. So that's services like Hoopla that lets you read magazines and watch movies and TV shows. It's some libraries have genealogical services that you can access inside or outside the library. It is virtual lending. I know my own library, I moved to Milwaukee in spring 2020, and most of the libraries were shut down, but my library still let me sign up for a card online, and I could use that card, just my virtual card number, to check out books, or to reserve books, rather, and to check out ebooks and to watch movies, even though normally you'd have to walk into a library and show all these different kinds of proof of residence. You know, they really streamlined that process. And then you did absolutely also see libraries physically taking their Wi-Fi routers to the closest window, so that even while libraries were shut down, the libraries are such a central hub for people to be able to have free access to internet if they maybe can't get it in their homes or can't afford it. And so they were trying to make it really easy for people to access that even while the library was closed.
Well, Maddie, thank you for joining us and for sharing your reporting.
Thank you for having me.
Madeline Fox reports on education for WPR. Right now, we're talking about how Wisconsin libraries are using federal relief grants they received during the pandemic. We're bringing into the conversation right now Leah Langby. Leah is Library Development and Youth Services Coordinator for the Wisconsin organization Inspiring and Facilitating Library Success, or IFLIS. Leah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, good to have you. And Leah, I understand that in the application process for these grants, you were talking with libraries in your system and elsewhere about the needs they had and kind of ideas they had for spending potential grant money. At that point, what kind of things did you hear?
Well, we didn't have a very large window of time. We had about 2.5 weeks to figure out what, you know, what the needs were and that within the parameters of the grant, and then write an application. So we were really working fast. So we went to them with several options, and we wrote, I was collaborating with colleagues from a couple of other library systems serving other counties. And so we worked on, I think it was 4 different grants. Proposals, and we just got one funded. But things like outdoor, we were looking at moving some services outdoors, so outdoor seating opportunities, charging stations that were outdoors, outdoor pickup lockers so that people could pick up materials outside. Those were some of the things that didn't get funded. And then the things that did were some outdoor and indoor sort of alternative programming options. So we are purchasing 11 different book bikes for communities that range in size from Superior. So that's like the tiniest library that we're getting one for is Boulder Junction, which has a population of under 1,000. And then some pop-up canopies for people to take their material, you know, for libraries to take programs and or materials and services out outside, whether it's out just out in their front yard or out to the community festival or the park or the swimming pool or things like that. And then we also got some hybrid programming kits for libraries that are providing a lot of libraries really dove headfirst into online programming, and they're looking for ways to make it possible to continue to offer a virtual option for folks for who have transportation issues or health issues or other issues that make it hard for them to come into the library. But still have some in-person options. So yeah, those are some of the things that we, those are the things that we are purchasing with our grant.
And we mentioned it earlier with Maddie, but you mentioned a few things there, the book bikes and the outdoor events that seem to pick up on this theme of really getting outside and into the community and not just being, you know, within the four walls of a library. How important is that to the library mission?
Well, I think it depends, you know, every library has a different, has a slightly different mission, but I think, most public libraries recognize the importance of going to where people are and connecting with them. A lot of folks don't really, we're still hearing from some people that they don't realize the libraries are back open and providing services, even though they were providing services all along. And so partly it's just like getting the word out. There are people who in our system, 81% of the libraries in our system are fine free, but I think a lot of people don't know that. They think of libraries as a place, you know, they might have associations with libraries that are less positive. And so it's really important for libraries to have a chance to get out there and share information and be there, you know, like the book bikes, people have a chance to take the library services, materials, sign up for cards, even art projects or makerspace materials out to reference services and stuff like that, out to places like, you know, trailer parks and the swimming pool and local parks and things like that, where people might not have, you know, been library users in the past. And it would be, it's a great opportunity to reach a broader segment of the population.
And from the librarians and the other staff you work with at libraries, is there a sense of excitement when they get to kind of like launch one of those new programs and work on something like that?
Oh, definitely. I think the trickiest part, I think most librarians have lots of excitement and passion, and maybe sometimes not as much in terms of capacity. And so having an opportunity like this to have at least some of the materials that are, you know, made available is very exciting to them. Some of these, especially very small communities, don't really have a lot of spare change hanging around for things like, you know, a book bike, which is a sizable expense, or even a, you know, like a pop-up canopy or a speaker microphone kind of thing that will allow for hybrid meetings. So it is pretty exciting to have an influx of that. And then along with that, we've provided some webinar opportunities for people to learn from other folks who are doing some outreach And so that's exciting too, to just get some ideas and try and keep it. Yeah. So I feel like I've said enough about that.
Sure. Yeah. And Leah, as we wrap up, obviously the pandemic has been a challenging and unique time, to say the least, for a lot of different sectors. I'm just curious, from your standpoint and with your library system, what has the last couple of years been like? Where do you, can you reflect a little bit on how things were in the midst of the pandemic and how you're feeling now about the future?
Oh, well, that's a big question. I think the libraries, at least the libraries that I interact with in our system, have been just steadfast in trying to find ways to continue to serve their communities. They've always been an integral part of their communities and part of the health and support to their communities. And when things were limited to more virtual interactions, that was really, really challenging for folks. It's very exciting to be able to be opening back up for in-person programming and things like that. I think people are very excited about it. It's also, it's a challenging time to be a human in general, and serving the public and seeing the needs that are out there it's definitely challenging, I think, for folks, but they're, I can't say enough about how impressed I am by how they are rising to the challenge.
Sure. Well, Leah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Leah Langby is Library Development and Youth Services Coordinator for Inspiring and Facilitating Library Success. She talked with us about how libraries around the state are planning to use federal relief money for projects to advance goals of providing a wide variety of community services.
Now we are opening up the phone lines for you. We want to hear from you about your local library now at 800-642-1234. What do you like about it or the people who work there? What value do you see it bringing to your community? Did you grow up going to the library? Do you go to one now with your maybe kids or grandkids? And what do you rely on the library for? The materials, books, CDs, DVDs, and more, electronic resources? Or maybe you've done job searches at a library, gone to events and programming there, or more. And if you work at a library yourself, what do you wish your community knew about your library? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter.
I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about libraries in Wisconsin. Earlier, we heard from a WPR reporter and a Wisconsin Library Support Organization leader about how libraries around the state are using federal relief funds for new projects.
And now we want to hear from you about your local library. What makes it special? What did you check out last? Why is having a library important to your community? Give a shout out now to your local library system at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go right to the call, to the phone lines. We have Sam in Madison with us. Hi, Sam.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Very good. I actually work at the Madison Central Library. I work in the makerspace. It's an art space called The Bubbler.
And what kind of things do you work on there, Sam?
We do a lot of different events, a ton of different community outreach events. I can't remember what her name was, but she was saying how, we go out into the community a lot to local parks, different stuff. But I do a lot of screen printing workshops. There's a lot of mural projects. It's a makerspace in the library. It's a fantastic resource. It's open most days, normal business hours. It's great. I wish more people knew about it.
Great. Sam, thank you so much for that call at 800-642-1234. We're taking your shout outs for your local library system, things you love about it, how you use your local library. Once again, that number is 800-642-1234. 1234. We heard from Central Time producer Rachel Vasquez here, who said she recently visited the Fitchburg Public Library and says it was just lovely. Rachel says she loves how quiet and peaceful libraries are and loves the crinkly sound of the plastic covers on library books. That's a unique take, Rachel, but thank you so much. Let's go back to our phones now. We have Wayne in the San Francisco Bay Area right now. Hi, Wayne.
Good afternoon. I wanted to recognize the Rice Lake Library for a service that they provided now some, 17 years ago. I was just newly graduated from Tulane University School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine in New Orleans in a PhD in environmental health. Shortly after that, this was 2005, I had to evacuate New Orleans ahead of Hurricane Katrina. And, of course, communications and services and so forth were drastically disrupted in all of Louisiana, or a good share of it. I needed to contact people within the State Department of Environmental Quality and also, excuse me, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I lost my voice here. at any rate, the Rice Lake Library was instrumental in me using the internet services there in order to contact government agencies, both federal and state, at a time when I didn't have internet service upon my arrival initially. Okay. So they were very kind and gave me almost unlimited access once I explained my purpose, and some other resources also that were just exceedingly helpful.
Got it. So, Wayne, thanks so much for sharing that story and for giving us a call from San Francisco today. Let's go back to the phones here. Linda is with us in Middleton. Hi, Linda.
Hi there. I'm new to Middleton, so I really haven't been to this library too much, but I was calling about the Central Library and also the Lakeview Library. I've rented art from there. I've done research there, and they've done research for me. They had a toy rental for a period of time at Lakeview. I've been to the book. Is it the Madison Book Fair?
I believe so,
yeah.
I'm
not sure if that's the right. Yeah, that was wonderful. I've been to several of those lectures. And let's see, at Lakeview, there were public meetings for different neighborhood and civic things. I don't know if I've done taxes there and certainly used the computer, especially when computers were new. Gotcha. So that's how I've used the library system.
Well, Linda, thank you so much for the call and the shout out there to the Madison Central and Lakeview library branches. Let's go next to Catherine in Iron River. Hi, Catherine.
Hello.
What did you want to shout out your local library for?
Well, Iron River Library is in the northern part of Wisconsin. We have excellent librarian, Jackie Pooler. She's as good as any computer I've ever worked on. And one thing I'm really proud of us for doing is we have recently installed a hearing loop system in our library for those patrons that have hearing disabilities, which is quite helpful for them. And we also have a genealogy corner people can do research on, two book clubs, summer reading programs, and many other programs offered throughout the year. So, and our population within our town is just a little over 1,100, but we service a great deal of the rural area around us. So it's quite a resource for the entire community.
Wonderful. Catherine, thank you so much for sharing. And thanks to everyone who called in to share their love for their local library. You can keep doing so on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the Federal Reserve is trying to fight inflation without causing a recession. The author of a new book tells us the Fed can only do so much and that we need bigger changes to the overall economy to fix things. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.